Welcome to WMKV Health Scope, a weekly discussion of health and wellness issues for older adults, their families, and caregivers. This call-in program is presented by 89.3 WMKV. To have your medical-related question concerning today's topic answered live on the air, call 513-772-9658. That's 772-WMKV. And now, WMKV Health Scope. We thank you for joining us here on HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV and now on 89.9 WLHS, now serving the Westchester area. In fact, we have a guest here from not too far from there. We are talking today about a very serious topic, and we hope to maybe learn a little bit more about when something that might be a mild, let's say a depression, becomes a bigger problem, or when we cross a threshold where we might need help. And we're talking today about mood disorders. Our special guest, Dr. Caleb Adler, the Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC Neuroscience Institute and the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence. And we'll give information about that a little bit later in the program here. But Dr. Adler, thank you, number one, for being here with us today.
I appreciate you inviting me.
Let's talk for just a little bit about setting some of the basics, if you will. I've heard about different types of mood disorders, some of which I can't even begin to pronounce. So let's talk a little bit about some of the different mood disorders. What are the general categories? What do they mean?
Okay, it's a good question, and it's potentially very confusing. And to some degree, it's because of the nature of psychiatric diagnoses. So psychiatric diagnoses, for the most part, they're not diagnosed based on a blood test or a brain scan, although I think we're certainly moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. But right now, they're really based on symptoms. And so we tend to subdivide mood disorders based on the symptoms with which someone presents, and those symptoms give us some idea of who might respond to this treatment, who might respond to that treatment, who might respond to this combination of medications and psychotherapy. And so in brief, you can think of mood disorders as being divided into major depression, which is just what the name sounds like. These are episodes of very significant depression that are really impairing. And bipolar disorder, where you have those same very similar episodes of major depression, but you also have these episodes of mania, which we can talk about if you're interested.
Sure, by all means, yes.
And then sometimes you'll work with someone who has kind of a long-term low-level depression that doesn't quite rise to what we'd think of as a quote-unquote major depression, but is still pretty significant and lasts a long time. And these days, that's typically termed a dysthymia disorder. Now, the older terms were used, and again, if you're interested, we can talk about that. And then sometimes you have people who have kind of minor manias with very significant depression. We might call that a subtype of bipolar disorder, or sometimes a minor mania with a minor depression that we might term cyclothymia. But I wouldn't get bogged down with the terms.
Right, with all the terms, right. But we sometimes just use that to pigeonhole something so we know what we're talking about. But largely it sounds like what we're talking about is some degree of depression and some degree of bipolar disorder are two of the major issues, if you will. And we'll talk more about those and about when something like, let's say a minor depression, you feel a little blue when you wake up on a rainy day, or you might even be affected by seasons and things like that. But when does something like that become a bigger issue where it starts to actually affect your life? And I know that there are I don't know if there are set thresholds at which somebody's affected, but I hope to get to that later in the program. And we're talking with Dr. Caleb Adler from the UC Neuroscience Institute and the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence. Let's talk about depression for just a moment. We've had representatives on here from the Mental Health Association talking about this and the whole concept of depression. At what point is depression a major issue, or when do you call it a significant form of depression as opposed to somebody, maybe the Reds lost last night, I don't feel so good about that, or a few things start happening wrong with the family, a few health issues, and does it snowball to a certain point where we say, wow, this is a depression as opposed to just feeling a little down?
You know, it's a really good question, really good point. I wish I had a really good answer. psychiatry is not rocket science.
Yes.
probably I shouldn't say that.
But I can understand. It's not totally empirical. You can't say that there is a set threshold, I can imagine.
Right. And as psychiatrists, we prefer to keep things simple. So In the end, really what we look at to decide, is this major depression, the overriding feature is it causing a problem? Is it, we might say, functionally impairing? Is it interfering with your work or your home or your ability to take care of things you need to take care of? If it's not, then it's not. If it's not interfering, it's not interfering. It's kind of a tautology. If it is interfering, then it's a problem. And now we need to treat it.
Certainly. And so that's one of the things I've even seen on some other websites and things like that, where they say that if it starts to affect more than X number of aspects of your life, job, lifestyle, right, things like that. But really it comes down, I think the diagnoses or the way to look at this is as different as each individual is different.
Yeah, exactly.
So it is, so we can't really just put a sticker on it and say, well, once you hit this threshold, you should seek psychiatric or psychological help.
If it's a problem, you should seek help. And the number one thing I say to a new patient is, why are you here? Right? What's the problem?
Yes.
People typically don't come to see me because they just want to chat.
Right.
You know, they're coming in for a reason. And so the number one thing I'll ask is, what brought you in here?
Mm-hmm.
And then we talk about that. And the one thing I'm really looking for is, what are the problems?
Yes.
You know, what's the problem that's resulting from the symptoms they're having? And then we can get into very specifics about the symptoms. But really the number one thing in making this kind of a decision, making this kind of a split between a major depression and just, you know, feeling blue, is it a problem? Can you cope with it?
That's a great point and a very good measuring stick, if you will. I mean, if it's something where you go, well, you know, I get distracted and suddenly I'm in a better mood, probably not a problem.
Right.
But if it's something where it's just kind of there on a regular basis and it doesn't let go and it is affecting your life, then... Yeah, and also, before we leave the depression area, we'll come back to it later, but before we leave the depression area, is it sometimes better if you're starting to notice that it is a little more pervasive, it's not really a problem yet, to maybe talk to either your primary care physician and or a psychiatrist to just say, hey, you know, I don't want this to get any worse. Is there a way to almost prophylactically talk about an issue?
Yeah, that's always a really, really good idea. If you feel like things are beginning to spiral and they haven't become a problem yet, but you feel it coming, then talking to a professional makes a lot of sense. And if you have a good relationship with your primary care doctor, then it makes absolute sense to talk to her or him and talk about this and see if they think it's worth treating or referring you on. If you don't have that kind of relationship already in place, then certainly you can see a psychiatrist or other mental health professional as well who can help work out maybe what's going on and what might be best for further treatment.
That's absolutely true. Dr. Caleb Adler is our special guest. We're going to open up the phone lines if you have a question on mood disorders today. We've been talking so far just a little bit about depression. We'll get to bipolar disorder. We'll talk about different treatments. We'll talk about some of the options, you know, how this affects friends, family, you know, all of your relationships, whether stress can add to this or amplify some of the feelings. But if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 513-772-9658. That's our local number. Or toll-free 877-772-9658. We'll give the numbers again about the halfway point here. But we have Dr. Adler here with us. You also mentioned bipolar disorder.
Right.
And some people have maybe the old term, I guess, was what, manic depression or something
exactly.
like that. Tell us what happens in bipolar disorder.
So the most important feature of bipolar disorder is that in addition to the depression, people experience manic episodes. And these are episodes where, in some sense, it's the polar opposite of a depression, where instead of being down, your mood is unusually up. And really, in a full manic episode, it's like being high or really excited or hyper. Or sometimes it can manifest with just this extreme irritability that lasts typically for at least a week and is accompanied by a variety of symptoms, including decreased need for sleep potentially and kind of feelings of grandiosity in some cases, and just feelings that your thoughts are racing, so you can't focus. Your thoughts are going a mile a minute, and often that'll show up with this rapid speech. That may be the first thing people around you might notice, this rapid speech, where they just can't get a word in edgewise. And that's really the hallmark of bipolar disorder, having a combination of these depressive episodes and these manic episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some cases, the manic episode isn't quite as manic. It's something we'd call a hypomanic episode, kind of a little manic episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the real difference there between a hypomanic and a manic is that in a manic episode, it's causing, again, real problems in your life. Whereas in a hypomanic episode, it doesn't quite cause the problems. And that's the distinction we draw.
Right. And this is, again, we don't want anybody to say, oh, wow, I got excited about something the other day. Maybe I'm manic depressive. We're not saying that. I mean, there are people who get like a creative urge. For instance, around here, we'll actually have a time where just out of a meeting in the hallway, somebody will come up with an idea for a promo to put on the air. And we'll be manic for a couple of hours, maybe putting this whole thing together. But then things kind of calm down. We get the thing done and all that. It's not like we're going on about it for days or weeks on end. So it's okay to get manic or to be excited about things. But it's when it seems to kind of really have those, again, the bipolar effects where you go from maybe a deep or a mild depression to these manic moments, but they last for longer. Is that?
And things are getting out of control.
Right.
I mean, after all, we all have emotions.
Sure. Oh, and, heavens, yes.
Right. And if we had a medication that made the emotions go away, that probably would be a bad thing. Nobody would want it, right? We certainly don't want emotions to go away. We all have emotional changes, switches. I joke, we have a mania rating scale that we often use where up around 20 is where you start thinking about, you know, mania. And I probably live at about a 10. So,
well, if you're passionate about what you do, most people do probably live between a 10 and a 15. Yeah,
exactly. So you want to be very careful about not overdiagnosing.
Right.
You know, mood swings are just, frankly, enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really, again, it comes back to this functional impairment. Right? If it's causing problems, it's a problem. If it's not, it's not.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, about this whole idea of when it starts causing problems, because I think, number one, for many people, when you talk about a mental health disorder or a mood disorder, some people automatically put a stigma on that. We've talked with our friends from the Mental Health Association about trying to remove the stigma of needing to talk to a mental health professional. I mean, that there's nothing wrong with that. But yet some people, you know, we've heard all the terrible terms, and we're not going to raise all the terms here. But, you know, people start, you know, using these derogatory terms. In many ways, seeing a mental health professional is really not a lot different than going to a podiatrist or going to another specialist when you really think about it. Yet somehow there's a stigma there.
Right.
To what extent do friends, family, and maybe even a primary care physician come into play in convincing someone or urging someone to maybe get help?
Well, I think it's just that. They do need to come into play. And the stigma has always been amazing to me. I mean, the brain is another organ.
Right.
I mean, having seizures is not something that we stigmatize.
Right.
And yet, having bipolar disorder is really no different. But what's ironic is that if you look back historically, at one point, seizures were stigmatized. And in fact, were listed as a psychiatric disorder in some of the early census categories. And I'm old enough to remember when cancer was stigmatized.
Mm-hmm.
When people who got cancer, it wasn't talked about. Obituaries wouldn't mention it because it was somehow, I've never understood why, but was somehow thought of as something to be embarrassed about, as if somehow you did something to get cancer. Nowadays, I tell students about that, and they look at me, they look at me, you know, goggle-eyed. They can't understand, and honestly, I can't understand it either, but it was true. And I'm hoping in the future, people are going to look back at the stigma around psychiatric illness in much the same way. Like, how could anyone possibly stigmatize what's just another illness, but
right. And yet it is out there. And, you know, whether it's comedians continuing to make jokes about things or saying this or, you know, but there are sometimes very insensitive things that are said that I think actually sometimes put a barrier up for someone to seek the help. What are there good ways that you might recommend for either families or friends to talk to somebody who they think may need help, and maybe they are witnessing where it is having a major effect on someone's life. How, have you heard any really good stories of how families or loved ones have gotten someone to actually come to the point where they say, yes, I do need the help?
I think some of the most successful methods have really involved just pointing out the problems. Not gotten into some idea of making a diagnosis, just saying, look, you told me you're having a problem with this. This is clearly causing a problem for you in this way or this way or this way. Why don't we at least talk to somebody and see if we can deal with it? You know, we don't need to get tied up with diagnoses. Here's a problem. Let's address it. And often family members have success with that. In addition, a lot of these things have got genetic components. Bipolar disorder in particular is probably one of the most, one of the psychiatric disorders that's most closely tied to genetics. And so there's often a family member, and sometimes that's helpful to universalize it or tie it in with someone and say, you know, I had something very similar, or your uncle, whoever, you went through some of this and found that this treatment or this intervention was helpful. And sometimes that helps too.
And that's another thing that I think is something that one of the questions I hope to ask you today is, what do we understand today that we didn't understand 10 years ago? I have a feeling things like genetic ties to some of these illnesses are one of the areas that is potentially groundbreaking here.
Potentially. Unfortunately, genetic ties, the amount, we don't know that much more than we did 10 years ago, oddly
really?
Enough.
Really?
Well, even 10 years ago, we knew how closely this ran in families, because that's based on traditional genetics. You know, we construct family trees, and you can really see how tightly bipolar disorder, for instance, is associated with these family lineages, and to some degree schizophrenia, and to some degree depression. And we could really see the genetic basis in this kind of overall classical genetic way. There have been a lot of studies now looking to try to find the real genetic markers, and they've had some limited success. The problem is that these are very variable illnesses. They're really, in a sense, they're not an illness, they're a syndrome, right? A collection of illnesses, probably. Mm-hmm. And that confuses the picture. And so there have not been great genetic findings. There have been some that have helped suggest some of the things that may be going on in the brain that are associated with some of these mood changes. But there's nothing that's definitive. And so we certainly are not particularly close to having a blood test for any of these disorders.
Right. And I promise we'll get back to treatment and diagnoses here as well. But I imagine, too, one of the other things that kind of muddies the water is it genetic or is it behavioral? In other words, if your father or mother treats you a certain way, do you learn that that's the way right. that they, you know, I imagine there's a behavioral component sure. or a learning component as well. And it's back to nature versus nurture. On that too, so that kind of muddies the water as far as what we understand and learn.
It does, and that's true for all of medicine, right? Everything mm-hmm. is a combination. So cancer, there are clearly genetic components to yes. cancer. You see cancer-prone families. On the other hand, there are clearly environmental influences. You've got identical twins who differ a great deal, or who differ in the cancers they develop, if at all. And we see that in psychiatric disorders as well. So you can have what we call monozygotic twins, that is identical twins, who are by definition, they're genetically identical, who will differ in the psychiatric disorder, or in one develops one and one doesn't, because, of course, there is an environmental component. Some of that may be behavioral, right, how your mm-hmm. family raises you. I don't think we can minimize that. I mean, the developing brain is really guided by early influences in some very significant ways that are, you know, physiologically crucial, but also things that might have happened while you're in the womb.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
They can affect some of these developmental issues.
So, yeah, and again, I think the brain, we feel like we understand a certain amount of it, but the brain is by far and away, it seems to me, the most complex organ that we have. I mean, that might be very trite. It might be one person's take, but I'll tell you, what we understand of the brain seems to me anyway that's one of the great frontiers yet for medicine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And even since I was in medical school, things that I was taught in medical school as not as maybe true, but as definitively true have turned out to be wrong about brain physiology, you know, about how the brain is working, about how various aspects or areas of the brain are involved. things that I remember being told by smart people were definitively true turned out not to be true.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we're talking about mood disorders today on WMKV's Health Scope here on 89.3, now also on 89.9 WLHS, with Dr. Caleb Adler, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC Neuroscience Institute, the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence as well. By the way, their phone number, if you would like more information, is 513-558-7700. Also a toll-free number, because there is a lot of great research and a lot of people come to UC Neuroscience Institute from all over the world, 866-941-UCNI. We'll give you the numbers, because I always hate looking up the letters. It's 866-941-UCNI. 8264. And Dr. Caleb Adler is here with us. We also have open phone lines. We'll give those in a little bit here. Now, we've talked a little bit about depression, about bipolar disorder. Thank you for letting me go off on a little tangent here about what we understand about these and what we understand about mental illness, and also addressing the stigma, because I still think that there is one, and I hope that through discussions like this that we can get rid of that, because as I said, if I go to a podiatrist, nobody's looking at me askance.
Right.
If I go to see a psychiatrist, nobody should look at me askance either, because I'm just trying to make myself better. That's what it's all about. But let's talk a little bit about treatments for either bipolar disorder or depression. Are there either medication treatments, or are there also there other forms of therapy that people can access?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really amazing. In the last, really, 15 years, or I say since the turn of the new millennium, which I count as January 1st, 2000, people do argue with me. The number of treatments for mania, medications alone, have more than tripled, and we've gone from having zero treatments FDA approved for bipolar depression to having now three.
Wow.
Which is still not a huge number.
I mean, just in the last 13 years, you're saying?
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
Things have really taken off. And we have more treatments for maintenance now, things that are FDA approved. And of course, as physicians, we often use things that are not approved that may be effective and for various reasons have never gotten a formal FDA approval. So the number of treatments have really increased. And we have a better understanding now of how some psychotherapeutic interventions, non-medication type interventions, can be really, really helpful in treating particularly bipolar depression and maintenance in bipolar disorder. And it's also effective in unipolar depression, just straight major depressive disorder as well. So there are really a lot of options. And we're beginning to have some research looking at the combination of these and showing how you can combine specific treatments to get even better response.
Psychiatry and treatment of mood disorders has gone beyond what most of us remember from back growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s as a kid and as a young adult. The vision was that someone sat there with a notebook and you laid on a couch and talked to them. I imagine there's some component of that, but I have a feeling that modern, even psychiatry in that day, I'm sure was well beyond that. But modern psychiatry is even farther beyond that, I have a feeling.
Well, I don't want to be picketed by psychoanalysts. So
okay, sorry.
Certainly the classic talking cure.
Yes.
Person on the couch with the psychoanalyst meeting with them.
And I didn't mean to say that was bad. I'm just saying that was the stereotype. But yeah.
That still happens. And there are people who benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that major mood disorders, bipolar disorder, really problematic depression, are not most amenable to that, and that's where you want more of a combination of some of these more modern, these newer psychotherapy techniques with medication. I don't think most analysts would disagree with me there.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the options have really, really, have very much increased, so that we've got a lot of medications that are effective and a lot of psychotherapeutic interventions that are effective, and a lot more ways of delivering these treatments now than we used to.
One of the things, too, that I hear whenever we have someone out from the UC Neuroscience Institute is kind of a multidisciplinary approach to things. Is that the case in this kind of therapy, if you will, for either bipolar or for depression? Are there different disciplines that come into play here?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was in training, I went to a a residency that was very psychotherapy oriented, very frankly psychoanalytically oriented. At the time, I thought I'd be a psychoanalyst. It didn't work out. And so we really trained as psychiatrists to combine psychotherapy with the medications within the same individual. And our residents still learn to do that. But more and more in today's medical environment, things get split. And so the psychotherapy is often done by a psychotherapeutically oriented professional. It could be a psychologist, could be a social worker, could be a psychiatrically trained nurse, where the medications are often managed by a psychiatrist, sometimes by a primary care physician who is psychiatrically savvy. And it's really important in those cases that we work collaboratively so that we are very careful to combine the treatments. But in addition, there are some newer studies looking at specific medications that may actually make psychotherapy more effective, you know, literally more effective, where it helps affect the ability of the brain to modify itself in response to psychotherapeutic interventions so that each can be more effective than they would be alone. So it's not just collaborating in this case, it's really actively collaborating on a specific combination of treatments to be most effective.
We have Dr. Caleb Adler here with us, who is with the UC Neuroscience Institute and the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence. We're getting ready to take a break. I want to mention that we have open phone lines. If you'd like to join us here on this Monday afternoon, 513-772-9658 or toll-free 877-772-9658. When we come back, I'd like to talk more about how a diagnosis is made. You know, at what point is there a diagnosis? What can people do to better prepare for a visit with a healthcare professional, whether it be for mood disorders or anything like that, such as having medications, having medical history to see if maybe there are some medical or biological reasons for some of this, as well as, you know, again, how family, friends become involved, stress. How do we learn more about bipolar and other mood disorders? And one of the big issues I want to find out is about local research that's going on here in the area as well as nationally. We have Dr. Caleb Adler with us. Again, you can join the conversation at 513-772-9658 or toll-free 877-772-9658. We'll be back with more of HealthScope right here on 89.3 FM and 89.9 FM. The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff and management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice. And we welcome you back to HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS. Our very special guest on today's show is Dr. Caleb Adler, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC Neuroscience Institute and also at the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence there. We are talking about mood disorders today. We've kind of laid out some of the groundwork here in the first half of the program where we talked about bipolar disorder a bit. We talked about depression a bit. I do want to ask you, before we get into the diagnosis, I don't even know where this falls into the gamut or whether it's something that is more or less a phenomenon rather than an illness. Is there anything to the seasonal affective disorder that we hear about? Or does that fall like under depression or something? Or is it something that's real?
Yes. It's not been uncontroversial in the past, but there does seem to be good research suggesting that some people have mood changes with the season. The classic example is to get more depressed in the fall and winter and then to feel better, even get a little manic-y or hypomanic in the spring and summer, although there are some people who reverse that and will get more up in the fall and get more depressed in the spring and summer. And it makes some sense. There are real hormonal changes with the season. Heat can certainly affect us. Light affects us in a lot of really very real physiologic ways. And so it makes some sense. And sometimes you do want to vary treatment based on seasons. I've certainly worked with people where we literally adjusted medication doses depending on the season of the year. because they needed more at certain times than needed up and at others.
Does it ever feel like you're trying to hit a moving target? Because our brains are so individualized. I mean, most of us, you could say, well, yeah, you know, some of our hearts are in better shape than others. But, you know, the heart is the heart in many cases. The lungs are the lungs in many cases. But the brain is the repository of what makes us us. Therefore, it seems to me that every patient is different. There's no cookie cutter necessarily diagnosis for absolutely everything.
It's one of the things that makes psychiatry so interesting. But there's good and bad to that.
Yes.
Because certainly the brain is so varied, and we understand it, frankly, so badly, that it is very much a moving target. On the other hand, people can't tell me how their heart is. I mean, they can tell me they're having chest pain. They can tell me they're skipping a beat. They can tell me it's going rapidly. But in a sense, the heart isn't you. It's a pump you carry around that keeps you living.
Yes.
I'm not minimizing the heart.
Glad
I have one. But but in a sense, with the brain, one of the interesting things, one of the fun things is that people can tell me how their brain is. They can tell me what their mood is, which is a reflection of what the brain is doing. They can tell me how they're thinking, which is a reflection of what the brain is doing. They can tell me about their memory and their focus and their concentration. And so I can get a real view of how that particular organ is functioning in a way that you can't do with most of the rest of the body. Can't really ask the heart how it's doing. I can't ask a kidney how it's flushing. Right?
But I never thought of it that way. That's pretty cool. So you have the best interface potentially there to be able to find out what's going on because the person can tell you what he or she is thinking.
Exactly.
Wow. Now, if they're being honest, that's another thing too. Is
right.
Is that one of the boundaries that you have to get on maybe a first visit? You think somebody's telling you what they want you to hear?
It can be an issue.
Or what you want to hear.
It can be. People want to make you happy.
Right.
And people don't always focus on the things I want them to focus on. And memory is malleable. You know, memory isn't a series of snapshots that we whip out at will. Memory is highly affected by our current feelings. And so we often talk about viewing the world through rose-colored glasses or sometimes viewing the world through mud-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. So it's not uncommon when I ask someone who's depressed, how long have you felt depressed? And they'll tell me, my whole life. Now, that may not be objectively true, but at that point, it does feel true because that depression is coloring everything, all their memories. And so it can be difficult sometimes to get an accurate picture, and that's where getting collaborative, you know, information is helpful. Records, family members, all of those things are crucial. And of course, it just touches on something else that I should have said. When we talked about collaborative care, of course, the most important collaboration is with the patient themselves.
Yes.
Because, as you said, everybody is different.
They're the repository of they know them better than anybody else.
Exactly.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about that. If somebody suspects maybe they have a mood disorder, maybe family's been talking to you about it or, you know, saying things, and maybe they sit down with their primary care physician initially, or they go to see a specialist because many plans allow that now.
Right.
What is the preparation? Should they bring things with them to the first visit to talk about this? Do lists of medications? Does a good medical history? It seems to me it would make sense to bring that, but is it really that important to have?
It's crucial.
Okay.
One, list of medications are unbelievably important. And to the extent possible, a list of the medications you may have taken in the past, because that may tell me about something about the history of the illness. It also tells me what's worked, right? There's no point in spending 20 minutes talking about a possible treatment only to learn that you tried it before and it didn't help. And so that's really important. And then a medical history, you know, a good medical history, because that's going to both affect the treatment, but it might also affect your presentation. It might tell me something more about what's going on. And you don't want to underplay the medical causes, you know, the non-brain causes of depression, because there are many of those. And then the degree that you can really give me any information about past treatments and social history, it's all helpful. And family members who can give more information are helpful, really as much as I can get.
And is it appropriate that there are times maybe where a family member may accompany in on a visit or something like that, or maybe on a subsequent visit?
Absolutely. Because the family member, again, can give me some more information about what's mm-hmm. going on. Now, ideally, I see the family member with the patient.
Sure.
I don't want to
sure.
get in a situation where I've got a he said, she said.
Right.
I want everyone on the same page.
Right, exactly.
And if there's a disagreement, tell me that, mm-hmm. that you recall things differently. We can discuss that.
Exactly.
But the more information I can get the better. And, of course, at some point, I am going to want to see the patient alone.
Oh, by all means. I would think right. so, yes. How do you come up with a diagnosis from all these discussions and all this input? Is it difficult to come up with a diagnosis in some cases?
Some. It's again, it's one of the fun things about psychiatry, mm-hmm. that everybody's different, and you take the information and you put it together, and you try to get a best diagnosis. And I say best diagnosis because, remember, we're not getting a blood test. We're not doing, in most cases, a brain mm-hmm. scan to look at anything. And so it's the best diagnosis I can get based on the information I have. But something I'll often tell residents is that we are essentially trying to get the plot of a movie based on a single still. Right?
So that's a great analogy.
Yeah, I've got you coming in, and depending on how much other information you're bringing me, I've got a snapshot of how you're doing right now. And from that, I'm
trying to
infer.
You don't even have the trailer to watch.
Exactly.
You just have a still, okay.
And I'm trying to infer everything. So, for instance, I've had individuals come in with a previous diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and mm-hmm. we've talked about the history, and I've said to them, the information you're giving me now doesn't sound like you meet criteria for bipolar disorder. But I will never say to somebody, you don't have bipolar disorder, because I don't know. I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. There might have been a very severe manic episode 2 years ago that, for whatever reason, I haven't heard about, that's not getting conveyed. I certainly didn't see it. I don't know. And frankly, I may say, I think you've got unipolar depression, and a month later, someone gets a full manic episode, and I look like an idiot. And that's okay. It happens. And so it's based on what I have now. But I think as psychiatrists, we always need to be modest about our diagnoses mm-hmm. because they're limited, and we need to be aware that they may well change. And that's happened to me.
And I can understand that. And I was going to say, on things like depression, bipolar disorder, any of these mood disorders, is it something that we ever totally beat, or is it just something that we control? In other words, you say, well, I had a cold, but I got over it. You know, something viral like that, that you can just kind of kick and get over it eventually. Right. What about mood disorders?
For many of us, I would think of mood disorders more like a seizure disorder, or diabetes is the example that's often
yes,
given.
Yes.
Something that's controllable, but you need to keep taking the medications. Mm-hmm. Now, I say many of us because everybody's different.
Exactly.
It's certainly possible that someone has a single severe depressive episode, maybe kicked off by problematic circumstances, and that's treated, and they're okay. Often, though, these things do tend to come back, and it's helpful to have medications long term. Now, the question would be, how do you make the trade-off between taking medicines, which often have side effects long-term, mm-hmm. versus relatively infrequent mood episodes? And that's something you're going to want to work out with your mental health professional to discuss that balance, depending on how severe the episodes have been, how often they occur, frankly, how well you like the medicines.
If you're just joining us, we have Dr. Caleb Adler here from the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute, UC Neuroscience Institute, and the Mood Disorder Center of Excellence. Their number is 558-7700 here in Cincinnati, or toll-free long distance is 866-941-8264. That spells out UCNI for the at least that's the initial reaction. So, sorry, had to get that one in. And we have Dr. Caleb Adler here with us. We're talking about mood disorders. Let's talk for a moment about research. You and I have both stated on this program, and you have forgotten more about psychiatry than I would ever know, but the bottom line is that we still have a lot to understand about the brain, a lot to understand about these mood disorders. What kind of research is being done here locally and maybe even on a national scope?
Well, nationally, there's a lot of research going on. Mm-hmm. Certainly, much of it funded by the federal government through the National Institute of Mental Health and other national institutes of health. Much of it funded by foundations such as the Brain and Behavior Foundation and other foundations that have been very, very generous historically. Certainly, the funding is down, but there is still funding. Locally, we've had a very active research program at the University of Cincinnati. In fact, we're one of the top institutions nationally for psychiatric research, and even higher on the list when you look at public institutions. And a lot of research is going on. Now, it tends to fall into two different categories. Some of it is foundation or federally funded and is initiated here. And much of that is more basic science, although there is some therapeutic research there too. And then some of it is these multi-site clinical trials that are often run by pharmaceutical companies who are looking ultimately to get approval for one of their medications. Now, they don't run these trials because they love us. They run these trials because they're hoping to get FDA approval and ultimately market these things.
Certainly.
But by being a site for these studies, it does give us the opportunity to offer these treatments to individuals who are local who might want to try something new, something that's not been effective, perhaps someone who hasn't responded to other treatments.
When we talk about the research, are we obviously on a pharmaceutical, we're trying to find out the efficacy of that medication and how well it treats the symptoms of that illness.
Right.
But in the other research, what are we studying there? Are we studying the complexities of the brain? Are we studying chemical reactions of the brain? What are we learning in the research on the the non-pharmaceutical level?
Well, in some cases, we're actually responding to treatment. We're studying treatment and treatment response, often to medications or interventions that are not the kind of things a pharmaceutical company would be interested in studying. So, for instance, Dr. DiBello and McNamara have been studying omega-3 fatty acids in a variety of psychiatric disorders. Again, it's not something that companies typically are going to be following because no one's going to patent omega-3 fatty acids and make a lot of money. And yet, there's a lot of promise there. And we also have some investigator-initiated studies looking at some other promising medications that, again, are not being pursued by pharmaceutical companies. So some of it really is really still treatment research in things that might be effective but aren't otherwise going to be studied. And then some of it is looking at how the brain works. So we use a lot of neuroimaging work where we're looking at functional magnetic resonance imaging, which studies areas of the brain that are active during mood states, between individuals who are diagnosed with a mood disorder and those who are not, how this might change with treatment and how that might be affected by the medications and what that might tell us about what's going on with the underlying illness. And then we can also look at some of the actual neurochemicals and how those chemicals change with treatment. And some other studies looking at white matter tracts, which are kind of like the telephone wires connecting buildings if your brain were a city, looking at how those might be affected or might vary. And so we're doing a lot of this more basic research. And more lately, we're making an effort to tie that into some of these genetic findings to get a better idea of how some of these basic genetic differences in people might affect both the brain function and then ultimately behavior, mood symptoms, and what have you.
And I have to say, to see your eyes light up when we're talking about the research and where things are headed, I think you actually went up to a 12. on the manic scale. So that's a good sign because that shows that there is hope that we'll understand a lot more about this and we'll understand the treatments and have better treatments. And the one thing I wish that we could find some way to do is remove the stigma. That's the other thing, but that's sociologically going to have to happen over a period of years. Just as you said, we've gotten past the stigma of cancer and the stigma of seizures. But, you know, how do you get rid of the stigma of seeing a health professional, a mental health professional in this case? And sometimes, you know, that's slower to come than others. But it is exciting that what you're talking about is you've got the big companies, the pharmaceutical companies who are tackling a lot of the major medication angles and then looking at everything like the different fatty acids and things like that that are not going to be commercially successful. But there are organizations like UC Neuroscience Institute and other organizations around the country doing this important research on different aspects of tackling mood disorders in one way or another. So it's really good that it's coming from two different angles, I guess, at least on this.
Right. I mean, we don't have the level of funding that a major pharmaceutical company has, but
it's still very important research. It needs to be done.
Right.
Yes. And by all means, Dr. Caleb Adler is here with us, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience. He is with the UC Neuroscience Institute. We do have open lines if you'd like to try to squeeze a question in our last 7 or 8 minutes here at 513-772-9658. That's 513-772-9658 or toll free 877-772-9658. And I say this, yes, pun intended, but thank you for letting us pick your brain a little bit here today about mood disorders and learning a little bit more about them, maybe demystifying them a little bit for those of us who this has touched lives of just about everyone has probably been touched, if not by the disorder itself, but a friend or a loved one right. or a family member has had this. Are there any numbers out there as to how many diagnoses of mental health disorders, or in this case, mood disorders? Is it rising? Is it falling? Where do those numbers come in?
In a lot of ways, it depends who you ask.
Okay.
Right. So classically, as someone who studies these, right, I have a built-in incentive to expand the number of people who have it. Right. So, you know, if I can define it broadly enough so that 50% of the population has a mood disorder, that's great because I'll get more funding.
Gotcha. So, I understand what you're saying.
So the problem is when you ask somebody like me, we're always pushing the numbers. Everybody's got it. Right? But that said, I think the numbers have been fairly stable.
Mm-hmm.
There is more of an effort to treat it. There has been some decrease in the level of stigma. I think some of that's driven by the research findings that really show a real, I want to say it wasn't real before, but have actually able to demonstrate these neurophysiologic findings and real changes in the brain of individuals with these disorders. And frankly, probably more has been driven by various celebrities who have been willing to come out and talk about their diagnoses.
Right.
And I don't want to endorse celebrity-obsessed culture, but it doesn't hurt when someone does that. And so I laud their efforts.
It tends to it legitimizes it for whatever reason. Right. In the minds of many people, say, wow, I can talk about this now.
Right, and that's a good thing, whatever you think about celebrity culture.
Right.
And so more people, I think, are getting diagnosed and treated because more people are now willing to get treated. And so we see some expansion in the number of diagnoses for that reason. And frankly, we've got more to offer now than would have been true even 10 years ago.
And I wanted to ask you in our remaining moments here, could we look forward? Where would you like to see us in 10 years, 10 years from now? Are there things that you would love to see come out of this research? Obviously, an absolute cure, I'm sure, would be the ultimate answer there. But realistically, within the next 10 years, what do you see happening in the field of psychiatry and in the study of mood disorders and in this whole area?
What I'd like to see is really getting psychiatry more closely tied to our underlying understanding of the brain. Right? Right now, we operate on these syndromic diagnoses based on symptoms, and that's all right. That's the way most of medicine has been for hundreds of years, even thousands of years. Mm. But I'd like to get a better understanding of how some of the underlying brain function leads to some of these disorders so we can have more focused treatments with fewer side effects and really deal with the specific pathology that's generating these symptoms rather than the kind of broad shotgun approach that I think is true now.
Very good. Dr. Caleb Adler here with us. And I just want to come back again for those people who may have just been joining us in the last half hour or so. We were talking at the beginning of the program about some of the major areas of mood disorders. And while it's hard to just pigeonhole everything, we talked about specifically depression. We talked about bipolar disorder. You mentioned, I think it's dysthymic. Is that correct?
Dysthymia. Sure.
And again, my understanding of that is that it's kind of like a lower level depression, but a much longer lasting.
Right.
Is that? So there are a lot of things here. And I want to come back in the final moments just also to the whole effect that this has on family, friends, loved ones, and how to take cues from that. If you're a potential patient or somebody, it's one thing to joke that somebody, that idea is really out there or something like that. You joke about that kind of thing. But if you're hearing on a constant basis that there is angst and that there is concern for your health as well as the health of those around you, and it has to do with potential mood disorders, that's a cue people should generally at least talk to their primary physician about, would you suggest?
Absolutely. And often the primary practitioner is a great first place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, if particularly for an older adult, who has not dealt with depression or symptoms of bipolar disorder in the past, who's just now beginning to show these symptoms, it's also a cue that maybe something going on more organic that needs to be addressed. You know, hormonal changes, even cancer can present with some of these symptoms. And so certainly if it's new, there may be some urgency in getting an evaluation, both just to treat, of course, the symptoms, the psychiatric disorder, but also to get a workup to see if there's something else going on.
And again, some people will be the first ones to say, oh, there's nothing wrong. There's, you know, and there are deniers a lot of the right. time, too. And sometimes it takes a little convincing on the behalf of the family or the friends, in that case, or loved ones, to do that. But the primary care physician, as you said, is a really good gatekeeper. Now, gatekeeper is not the right word, but a really good maybe first litmus test to see if maybe there is something going on here, because often that primary care physician knows your family history, right. knows your medical history, and that's always a good first source if you're not sure where else to start.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense.
As we wrap up here, I just wanted to ask also, just from your own standpoint, how did you get involved with psychiatry? What drove you to it?
It's funny. I think this is true for a lot of psychiatrists. I went into medical school fascinated by internal medicine, did my required rotation in psychiatry third year, and just found it really, really interesting, and did a few more rotations, elective rotations, and just got interested in the field and never wanted to leave.
Dr. Caleb Adler, thank you so much for taking time here with us today to talk about mood disorders.
Thank you again for having me.
Greatly appreciated. Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the UC Neuroscience Institute. You can find out a lot more locally here in Cincinnati at 513-558-7700 or the toll-free number 866-941-UCNI. That's also 8264. You can find out a lot more as well at uchealth.com/mood. And I know we got you up to at least a 12. I know we did. That was fantastic. It's great right. to have you here. And thank you for helping to talk a little bit about this. And let me take you off on a few tangents along the way. But I think something that's very important for people to understand about mental health issues and mood disorders.
Absolutely. And again, thanks for letting me come on.
Thank you so much to the UC Neuroscience Institute and to Deb. Thank you so much for bringing out wonderful guests here for us on HealthScope. I'm George Zahn. You've been listening to HealthScope on 89.3 FM WMKV and 89.9 WLHS in Westchester. You've been listening to WMKV HealthScope. Join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. for another edition of WMKV HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV Reading, Ohio.